Welcome to this week's What's the Story with me, Monique Chambers. My guest this week is Colin Fitz, but actually we're going to be turning the tables, and Colin is going to be interviewing me about a book that I recently wrote called Table 7.
Thank you, Monique, for giving me this opportunity to be on your radio program. How many books have you actually written?
I've actually written three, but only one has actually been published so far. The other one is just going through the fine-tuning process, and another one was written and rejected a number of times by publishers.
So the one that has been published, in what way, in what format was it published, and where can people get their hands on it?
Table 7 was actually published as an audiobook, so we'd recorded it with the voice of an actor, Thomas Camilleri, here in Malta, and sent it off to Audible, so it's available on Amazon, on Kindle, and also at audible.com.
When you say it's online, does that mean it's free, because a lot of people are used to things being free online, or do you buy a book like you would buy a physical book off Amazon, for example?
You can do either. If you're a new subscriber to Audible, for example, they allow you to download a certain number of books for free for a 30-day period, which is quite a good way to get you into them. And once you're hooked on audiobooks, it's quite something to get away from. Otherwise, you can buy it. It's $3 or $4 to be able to actually download a book. But they also have these subscription systems where you can buy a number of books over a month or over a week, whatever subscription level you wish to go for.
Tell us about Table 7. What's the story? What kind of book is it? What's the plot?
So Table 7, what it is, a table in a bistro in Valletta. I shan't tell you which one. But the table actually tells the story itself. So he talks about the people that come and go, the conversations they have. He reads a bit about their personality from the way they behave around the table. And of course, he knows who's been with somebody different at the same table and having different conversations. So he's more just of a narrator about the comings and goings.
And it's a he, is it? The table is a he?
He's definitely a he, and I was told more than one occasion that he must be gay as well, because he has quite a personality, and he notices things that straight men apparently wouldn't notice.
And what gave you the idea for the plot, for the book itself?
I'd been on a course with Marcel Darji-Smith. She teaches creative writing. And one of the homework exercises she'd given us was to go out and just, you know, notice a couple, take notes about them, write about them, and be able to describe them. So it was more practicing, not saying, you know, she has nice hair, she wore a nice top. So it was to really be able to describe people. And my characters, or the people I'd spotted, I ended up sort of making up a whole story about. And from there it went into the next people that came and sat at the next table, and then the story evolved that some of the characters actually end up interlinking.
So you'd recommend these creative writing courses?
I think they're very, very valuable. It teaches you some structure. It also makes you think in a different way, because lots of writing that we get to read now, with blogs and things being so short and so succinct, there's no real personality in them. It's as quick as you can get to the point, whereas when you read a novel, you want to have the descriptions, you want to know the characters, you want to be in the same place as them. And these creative writing courses actually pull that out of you. They make you stop, they make you think. You know, it's not the same as creative writing at school. That was an awful long time ago for me as well. But it does make you think in a different way, and you start to look at things in a different way and read books, in fact, in a different way as well.
Your relationship with books, what made you want to go on this creative writing course in the first place that eventually led to you writing these books? What is your relationship with books?
I'm a massive, massive bookworm. I read and collect children's books, and I have particular favourite authors, Geoffrey Archer, Anita Shrieve, and Anne Tyler mostly. I love to read, and whatever I can get my hands on, mostly magazines as well. But I decided that I thought I had a few stories in me, because I am always making up stories about people.
And you're also a writer for magazines. You had your own magazines, or have your own magazine.
Yes, I have indulge.com.mt, and also I've written for various magazines, from The In-Flight to Vamp to Gourmet, etc. So writing anything about food, things that I liked. You know, I recently wrote about a fashion article for First magazine. So the things that I'm interested in come really easily to me, but you want to be able to use all of those things actually in a book. And in fact, Table 7 originally I thought was going to be more about food. I was going to talk about the people, but I thought I was going to be almost reviewing the food and talking about the food they ate. But that lasted two chapters, and then it was like, no, that doesn't work. I want to talk about the people and their relationships. It was a bit more interesting.
And the difference between writing fact and writing fiction?
All the people are real. No, fact you know, can get a little turgid. It can be a bit boring if you're writing about the same thing week in, week out. So this way, at least actually in my profession, I'm a ghostwriter as well, so I have to be another character. So I could be a chef one week. I could be an athlete the next week. So you have to start to think, you know, in somebody else's life, really, which is different from being, you know, a middle-aged woman, essentially. But the you don't have the same freedom and flexibility, your vocabulary isn't stretched, you have to get things and grab people's attention in a completely different way when you're writing, you know, news or reviews. You're not, you don't want them to buy from you in that sense. When you're writing a novel, you want them to love or hate your characters or love or hate your story, and you want them to talk about your story.
To go back to my question about your relationship with books, apart from, obviously, having this program, and what you've said, your love affair with books all your life, you're also involved with various incentives, book reading incentives, and book salvage, would you say, or book restoration incentives?
Yeah, restoration. We run a charity called New Leaf at the National Library, where we have about 750,000 books to restore. We're well on our way, but we need as much help as we can, cleaning, assessing, you know, dusting and hoovering these books to see what's on the shelves. They've been there mostly unmoved for 200 years, and we want to be able to preserve the books and digitize them for future generations. And so far we've been going for 4 years. We've raised quite a lot of money, we've bought lots of new equipment, sponsored lots of people to come in, had lots of volunteers, but as always we need more and more. 750,000 books is quite a number to be able to get through.
I'm sure most Campus FM listeners would know all about the National Library of Malta and what it contains and why your work with all your colleagues is so important and raising money from generous sponsors, but for those perhaps who don't know what the National Library is all about, tell us a little bit.
The National Library was the last building built by the Knights, purposely built as a library, in fact. And in the days of the Knights, when they died, they needed to leave 6/7 of their possessions to the order. Now, most of their possessions were books. There was one knight, in fact, who left 9,500 books to the National Library. So it's quite something. To you go in and there are incredible, incredible histories.
And this is between 1530 and 1798, when the Knights of St. John were in Malta.
Yes, and also obviously the National Library also holds every book that's written by a Maltese, anything about Malta as well. So they're obliged to hold it, even the newspapers and the magazines, which is, you know, takes quite a lot of storage.
So it's Malta's heart, Malta's repository of information, and that's why it is such an important part of Maltese history and Maltese current life.
Absolutely. You see researchers coming from all over the world to dig deep and find the information that's in the books here. And often we have, for example, we've just restored a set of encyclopedia, which were the first ever encyclopedia from Didier and D'Alembert. And Malta is the, I think, the second library only outside of, there's France and here, Paris and here, that has the full set of these encyclopedia. Oh. So it's quite something. It really is a treasure trove. And I do encourage people, if they haven't been since a child, although it hasn't changed much, please do go back, take your children and have a look and, you know, maybe donate some time.
It is indeed a beautiful building and the books are very atmospheric. You also are involved with the public library, I believe.
Yes, New Leaf did run some storytelling sessions, which actually the library has taken on for itself now, because now they've spread the programme out through many, many of their libraries, where we used to run children's reading sessions. Now they actually do them for older generations as well, so people that are no longer able to read for themselves. It actually gives them an outing in their, you know, the local libraries, where storytellers go out and tell stories there. So it's actually grown from what we started. We sort of did it more as a publicity stunt to be able to get attention for our cause, and we had lots of people, including myself, coming and reading stories to children. And that really did give us a good leg up the publicity ladder. But from there on, like I said, the library has taken it to different lengths, and they've made a real success of it.
Yes, it was a wonderful experience reading to children that time that you invited me to. Well, we've moved to another aspect of your life and your relationship with books when we should be focusing on your book. However, let's have a listen to part of the audiobook, and please introduce it.
So this I'm going to let you listen to the very, very first chapter, which is the exercise I spoke about earlier. It's a couple that I named Mimi and Gaston.
She doesn't look French. The occasional ben oui, her only contribution to the stilted conversation over their shared cold cuts and a cheese platter and a Santé Steph. Do the French ever drink anyone else's wine? Strawberry blonde dyed fine hair. Heavy block fringe with shaggy layers till her bare shoulders. She resembles Debbie Harry. Large gold hoop earrings. Her flesh evokes the feeling of a just ripe mango. Your finger would sink in if it pressed hard enough and leave a dent that would eventually flatten. Her arms are mottled, stodgy and pale. There was too much flesh spilling over the almost transparent white stretch tube, which looks low cost from the high street. Eyebrows arched like a Nike swoosh and filled in with a 2 terracotta pencil. Large hazel doe eyes, long fair lashes, smudged eyeliner, perhaps yesterday's makeup. That slept in look that is really quite impossible to achieve on purpose. Or maybe she'd cried earlier. She looks tired. Sad. Pretty face, though. With a button nose, peachy voluptuous cheeks dropping into a moody pout. To the waitress, she granted a wide white smile. I'm sure she was once sexy. Large pores blemish her face and her skin's a touch greasy. She looks like she's let go of herself, but is still in time to halt the decline. They pick randomly at the food, not interested in the attention that the sous chef, Paul, in Malton as a condiment from his catering college in the UK, has given this sharing plate. He shapes the cheeses, the Comte into frilled edge squares, the goat's cheese, normally round, he takes the trouble of shaping into a flower head. The pecorino is threaded alternately with green and red grapes in cubes on skewers, thrust into a melon skin. And the meats are curled and coiled and folded like napkins with relishes and pickles in miniature dishes placed next to their ideal partner. Her shoulders are slouched, elbows on me with a cigarette in her right hand, held like a man at a bar would hold his, drooping downwards. It's not an accessory, it's a need. She's impatient to leave and light it. I can feel her foot rapidly tapping the floor. She seems bored by her company. Perhaps her husband? She is wearing a wedding band. She's looking down, and he's paying more attention to the raindrops and the patterns they're creating on the window.
If you've just joined us, my name is Colin Fitz, and definitely not Monique Chambers. I'm actually interviewing Monique as part of her series What's the Story on Campus FM, a program that you can hear on Campus FM 103.7 and also on the website. When did you first start writing? How long have you been writing?
I think pretty much the same as most of the authors I've interviewed when I was a child, but I was really into poetry and Rudyard Kipling and The Wind in the Willows, and it was all about animals. It was never really about people, and I had quite a vivid imagination, giving, again, creatures personalities and imagining the things that they would do. I'm sure it's just influenced by, you know, cartoons that you would watch at the time, really. So that was where it was, and I remember writing and winning a competition at school, and I won a banknote that was framed. It was a banknote that was actually going out of circulation, but I was very, very happy with my prize.
Was this a school in England?
No, actually, I went to school in Germany, because my father was in the forces. Mm-hmm. So I still treasure my banknote. It was a 2,000 mark note. But yes, it started then as a primary school child and just carried on. You know, lots of scraps of stories, and I've got one-line poems and some longer poetry written as well, but those are probably too personal to actually publish under my own name. So yeah.
I have interviewed you on a program I did on Campus FM called Minainen Baranin, Malta Through Foreign Eyes. I'm not sure people are aware of your backstory, perhaps, the people who have only listened to What's the Story. So very quickly, can we just talk a little bit about your background and your relationship with Malta? I mean, you are half Maltese,
yes,
aren't you?
Yes, my mother's Maltese, and she married a British soldier here in 1964. Then they moved to Germany, where my sister was born, and shortly afterwards moved to the UK, where I was born, and then we went back to Germany until I was 18. Went to boarding school in the UK and moved here myself, eventually, when I was 35, having had a career in PR and marketing, ghostwriting for people as well, and finally realised that I could actually do that job in Malta and not come here 1 week a month and stay in England 3 weeks. I could actually work from Malta 3 weeks a month and stay in England 1 week. So that the penny finally dropped about 10 years ago. And when I came here, I ended up writing for Malta Today. I wrote about tourism and food. I used to do a review column and also Gourmet magazine for a while. Then I set up my own magazine, Indulge, for 5 years. And like I said, I've written for various magazines and papers on various subjects, from paint to TV programs, to food, travel, referred to. I was the person who was behind the article, in fact. So
let's go back to your book, Table 7, your audio book. First of all, did you consciously decide to make it an audio book? Why didn't you go for the normal or traditional format of book?
I think I decided that way because I actually listen to a lot of radio plays and readings myself. I find it a good way to multitask, so if I'm doing something really turgid and boring, I actually put on Radio 4 and I listen to all the classic comedies or a book reading, and somehow, you know, that pile of ironing or that sorting out or that, you know, filing just becomes much, much easier. And when I wrote the book, I actually wrote it for a BBC competition, and it was for a radio play competition. But when I realised that it would be quite dull having just a table sort of as the character, because the other characters don't speak much, strangely. The table actually does most of the narration. And you had to have a limit on the characters, so all these restrictions on it, so it was never going to be able to be put forward for the BBC. And so I thought a radio play wasn't the way to go, but perhaps an audiobook, you know, and it lost just over half an hour, was the way to go.
Did you know the full plot of the book before you started?
No, not at all, no. And as the characters come in, because you think you know them because you've seen someone who sparked it, you do pull in little snippets of people that you know, or, you know, sometimes there's a little bit of a dig you want to make at somebody. So it's you've built these characters and you do plant things that eventually became relationships between people that weren't at the table at the same time. There are, you know, there's a marriage proposal.
Yes, do tell us some of the story and how it develops without giving any, without spoilers.
Yeah, so there's lots of, you know, things that happen in everyday life. So if you think about the things you were talking about at dinner to your friends, some of those conversations might be in the book.
Not too many proposals, though.
So, not in my case either, don't worry.
Let's listen to another excerpt from the book Table 7 by Monique Chambers. Monique, which excerpt shall we be listening to now?
This is a bit of a sad one, actually. This is a young lady called Rebecca who's having supper with her father, and the mum and dad are getting divorced, and Rebecca just wants to ask a few questions.
Chapter 11. Steve and Rebecca. Weekend Dad.
He's trying so hard to be upbeat, but I can feel the tension. They're staring at the menus, but not focusing on them. He looks up and suggests a pizza. Usually a winner, he thinks, and maybe it'll break the silence. They must keep in regular contact, as he knows the names of her friends, Millie, Sarah, Tricia. And what's been happening at school this week? The spats in the corridors, the interesting lesson where Oscar Wilde's The Importance of Being Earnest was introduced, the fact that she has a piano exam next Tuesday. Ta? The slight figure in tomboyish clothes pipes up. When you and Mum, you know, divorce. She looks down at me. I can see her face is sad, her eyes welling up. Well, what happens then? I mean, do you need to divorce? Aren't you both happier now anyway? And do we have to go to court there? And you two won't stand next to each other, and I'll have to choose whose hand I hold, and there. She looks over at him under her fringe. I'm scared. He gently gets up from his chair and takes a step towards his daughter. He crouches down, opens his arms, and gestures her into them. Bex! Divorce is just paperwork, really. It just sort of tidies things up legally. He wipes a tear from her cheek with his comparatively giant hand. Nothing changes between us. You don't even have to come, honey. We'll be reading the papers we've been working on to make sure everything is fair, that we both get to spend time with you, that the house is covered and things like that. All right.
Campus FM 103.7, you're listening to What's the Story? The program usually presented by Monique Chambers, but Monique Chambers is today being interviewed by me, Colin Fitz, about her audiobook, to be exact, Table 7. We've just heard Thomas Camilleri read an excerpt there. Now, Monique, the plot itself, though, it doesn't sound like it has a beginning, a middle, and an end, or does it?
It does, because one of the early guests at the table, who is actually on the cover of the book, he isn't a very nice man, but he appears early on in that chapter, second chapter, and then he appears in the very last chapter, or he's referred to in the very last chapter. So listeners who have paid attention to the book, they, although they see some other stories coming in and out of the book, they'll notice that James is at the beginning and at the end of the story, so he actually holds it all together.
So there's a sort of main plot and lots of subplots.
Yes, because there are lots of people that come into the table, or come into the cafe and sit at the table, and some of them come back with somebody else. So the table can, he recognizes them by their manner or their moves or their menu choices or something. So if you do pay attention, it's only 33 minutes, if you do pay attention, you'll be able to hear those relationships and get a little bit shocked yourself, I think.
Now, what are you working on now? You mentioned a possible sequel. What's in store for the future?
I'm actually writing a book about a car now, a hire car, and the people that go in and out of this particular hire car. But I've been clever enough this time to base it in Milan. So I have to keep going to Milan to research, obviously, where the car will have been and the types of people and the story itself.
What a shame you have to travel so much.
I know, it's awful. And another book I've drafted, which is just going through the fine-tuning now, is another children's book, which I'm hoping will be a bit more successful than the last one. Mm-hmm. And it's actually an educational book about clouds.
An educational book about clouds. That's unusual, but intriguing. Now, when you write, how do you write? Do you find yourself writing in a quiet room? Do you need music? Do you have a particular pet that has to be present to inspire you?
It's actually not very glamorous. I generally wake up in the middle of the night with a line or with one of the characters, and I go into my bathroom and I write in there. So my partner often finds me in the bathroom using the toilet as my desk with my laptop there, and I'm tapping and tapping away. And then once I've got to the end of the dialogue or got to the end of the paragraph, whatever, then I can sort of relax and go back to sleep. I don't really have a structured approach to writing. Even when I wrote Table 7, I had to keep going back to remember what they were wearing and bits of their character, because you're inventing a lot of characters in a very short space of time. So remembering all of their traits, because they're not exactly a person that you know. So some people have pictures and lines drawn to them and family trees. I didn't really have any of that. It kind of just flows, and when it flows, it has to go down on paper, whether I stop the car and I scribble something and then try and remember what that scribble is supposed to say later in the day. But generally, I'm a middle of the night writer.
And how long did it take you to write this 33-minute audiobook?
It probably took, in total, about 3 weeks. So not very long, but that was actually spread over about 2 years, because I'd been on the course with Marcel Darjee-Smith one summer, wrote this piece, and this couple just wouldn't leave me. So then the next couple came along, and then, you know, so then it sort of built and built and built. And then eventually, you know, after not going forward with the BBC play, etc., it kind of morphed into a book then very quickly, because then you had to edit it down and make it not he said, she said, you know, and turn it into dialogue. So it probably took 3 weeks in total, but over 2 years.
And when was that moment when you finally said, "Oh, this is it, it's ready, it's finished"? What did it feel like, and did it take a long time to get there, lots of rewrites?
Not lots of rewrites, but it was pretty scary. I actually had a friend staying with me from the States when I'd wrapped it up, and I'd asked a friend locally to look at it for me. In fact, she was unwell. She was recovering from an operation, and I didn't tell her I'd written it. I sent her a chapter a day while she was recuperating. And after the third chapter, she begged me for the whole thing and said, this is fantastic, let me have the whole thing. And when I let her have the whole thing, she was like, okay, who wrote this book? Who wrote this book? And so when I told her, she's like, oh, I've got to publish it. So I was like, no, I need to record it. So then we sort of worked out how to record it, and I had Pierre Zamit doing the introductions for me. So we did everything, you know, professionally in studios.
Yes, another fine actress as well.
Yes, and then so that was all wrapped up, and Pierre hadn't actually heard the whole story when she did the voiceovers. We sort of scripted what she had to do, and then of course I was brave enough to let her listen to it. It's quite something to let somebody see your work for the first time. So that's how it happened, quite quickly when it happened, really.
You came up with the idea for What's the Story, and I think it's one of the first programs on Maltese radio, on possibly on Campus FM, totally dedicated to books and the art of book writing. What are your feelings now that you've done almost an entire series of programs, the authors you've met, the scene in Malta? Yeah, a general idea of what you've explored in the last few weeks.
I think a few things. One, being able to speak to authors about their work in the way that you think about yours has been quite special. Also, finding out that they struggle at the same parts that you do, and realizing that, actually quite sadly, it's not a career in most people's cases. You think you're going to write that one book that's going to make it for you, and, you know, having spoken to publishers and marketeers, etc., you know that actually most people write books and have a day job, so that kind of takes the pressure off. And knowing that the other authors go through the same struggles, they can be as disorganized, there are some people who are super organized, really sort of makes you feel normal. And I just think if you've got a story, start to write it down. Some people write, you know, thousands of words every day. Some people write a paragraph a day. Whenever it comes to you, write it down, keep it in one place. Because one day you just never know. It could be the seedling to a fabulous idea.
Monique Chambers, what tips can you give budding authors as an author yourself now?
I think reading and listening to as many books as possible. Not just in your genre that you're generally interested in. I think you should sort of spread your library, your reading library. And also look at people, look at situations, and don't think that something's mundane to describe it. If you want to make somebody feel like they're there, I found this even with food writing, it's not just, oh, the wallpaper was blue. You know, the wallpaper was a sky blue, and when the light shone it, it looked like the moon was, you know, sharing its beams. I mean, you just don't say the wall was blue. You really, really think about what you're writing, and it's quite easy to be lazy, and very easy to be arrogant, but actually slow down and really, really describe things. For me, reading is really a selfish thing. I want to sit on my armchair, curl up with a cup of tea or a glass of wine, have my book and have nobody around me. And so I want to immerse into whatever world I'm going into. So you have to give me as much information as you possibly can, so that I'm there, I'm with your characters, I take them out with me, I refer to them, I talk to them. That's I would love that to happen with my work.
And with that, we conclude this show. I'm Colin Fitz, and I've been interviewing Monique Chambers on her own program on Campus FM. I shall leave her to conclude the program herself.
So thank you once again for listening, and there are a couple more episodes to go of What's the Story with me, Monique Chambers, on Campus FM.